Hey, well, regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Welcome to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. Glad you're with me on the program today, where we once again have no news. I mean, no news is still news when it comes to the Supreme Court. But today, orders were released from last week's conference. And once again, nothing having to do with gun bans or magazine bans in the court's orders. So this is the last scheduled release of orders for the Supreme Court right now. We do anticipate that there'll be a sort of a wrap-up conference and then at least one more batch of orders that'll be released before the court adjourns for the summer break. What happens with the two magazine ban cases, the three gun ban cases that are pending and have been pending before the Supreme Court for months? It's still kind of anybody's guess. I have to say, you know, I think that if the court were just going to deny these cases outright, we probably would have seen that before now. Whether or not these cases get granted cert, then the lower court opinions get vacated, and then they're remanded back down to the lower courts, or the Supreme Court just hangs on to these cases over the summer term and then deals with them in the fall when hopefully we'll have a decision from the Third Circuit regarding New Jersey's gun magazine ban and maybe a full-blown circuit court split. That remains to be seen. And in fact, we don't even know if the court has made up its mind, if the justices have decided, okay, this is what we're going to do with these cases. We don't know, but we can speculate. And joining me today to do that is Steve Gutowski from The Reload. We're going to talk about what's going on at the Supreme Court behind those closed doors, as well as what's going on with Virginia's gun and magazine ban set to take effect on July the 1st. We had a court hearing for an injunction last week. That request was denied. We've got two more hearings coming up this week, so two more cracks at it, keeping this law on ice before July 1st. But I have to say, if you're a Virginia gun owner, I would not – don't count on this law being enjoined. If you want to get your guns and magazines before they are banned for sale in Virginia, this is the week to do it, if you can find any left on the shelf, quite honestly. Anyway, good conversation with Steve Gutowski about everything that's going on in the courts right now. Take a look and a listen. Steven, good to see you, sir. Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, it was another day of waiting around for the Supreme Court and no news. We did get some big news last week with the Hamani case. Today is the last orders listed on the court's calendar. I still expect we're going to get a cleanup conference. We still have, 17 opinions outstanding. So, you know, we're getting towards the end of June. I know that the justices want to take their summer break. So we'll see how many opinions get released this Thursday. But then generally they do a cleanup conference, and we'll see what happens with these five hardware cases. I thought it was interesting. I mean, you've got three bans on so-called assault weapons, two of them challenging Connecticut's ban, one out of Cook County, Illinois. Then you've got Gators Custom Guns versus Washington, Duncan versus Bonta, the magazine bans. And the concern is, you know, if the Supreme Court rejects these cases, denies cert outright, then all of these laws can continue to be enforced, which for Duncan means existing magazine owners, all of a sudden now you're in, you know, possessing these magazines illegally. I saw Costas Moros from Second Amendment Foundation shared on X afterwards that after today, he's a little more optimistic that they're either going to GVR these cases or simply hold them over until the fall conference, which is unusual, but is not unheard of, right?
Yeah, I could see that happening. You know, obviously there's a faction of the court that wants to take hardware ban cases. We saw that with Snow, where there's four justices. In theory, they could just vote to take one up without anyone else on their side, but presumably they're listening to objections from, I would assume, either Roberts or Barrett, because those are the two conservatives who didn't vote or express that they want to take up a hardware ban case. And, you know, Roberts obviously has long had sort of institutionalist objections to taking certain things. And, you know, he certainly, it seems like he views himself as an institutionalist in the Supreme Court. And so he may be sort of blocking these cases from getting taken up by, you know, over more procedural objections, like the fact that there isn't a circuit split on these hardware ban cases. Although we are, as you've covered a lot and I've covered, we are perhaps on the cusp of a hardware ban circuit split on, you know, magazine or assault weapon ban, because Third Circuit is currently reviewing en banc the New Jersey case, where the balance of that court has shifted since, you know, in recent months, and there's some possibility that you're going to get a circuit split on that point. Actually, Kostas, we have a piece from him at the Reload this week that discusses how the Fifth Circuit in their silencer case may have created a sort of hardware ban circuit split as well. That's another possibility. But
yeah, you're talking about that with William Kirk and Hannah Hill this morning. And it's an interesting argument, right? That the circuit saying that suppressors are arms. Mm-hmm. You now have a circuit court split, not on the issue of suppressors, but whether, you know, accessories essentially can be treated as arms protected by the Second Amendment, or as the Ninth Circuit has said, no, they're just accessories. You can, you don't need a magazine for a firearm to function. So therefore they're not protected by the Second Amendment. That is a circuit court split. I don't know if it's the type that Chief Justice Roberts is waiting for. And I suspect that you're right. I think the holdup, given Kavanaugh's language when Snope was denied and he, you know, wrote that, hey, we're not saying Maryland's ban's okay. We're just, you know, we need this to issue to percolate. I expect we'll take this up in the next term or two. I suspect, too, that the issue is Chief Justice John Roberts saying that this issue is not yet ripe for Supreme Court review.
That's my best guess, right? That's what I can see and explain. Like, I know some people look at it and they think, well, maybe Roberts and Barrett will uphold assault weapons bans or unsure about their constitutionality, and that's why the other four conservatives aren't willing to grant a case, because they're just not sure what'll happen on the merits. But I don't see any particular reason to think that of Roberts or Barrett, at least from their either from oral arguments and the comments they've made there. I mean, Roberts is still talking in most recent oral arguments about how the Second Amendment is treated as a second-class right. That's still his mindset. There's just no hard evidence that they would vote to uphold a ban on the most popular rifle in the country, the AR-15, right? Which is, or magazines that are also immensely popular, because that would really undermine a lot of what they're building in terms of the Second Amendment jurisprudence. I think one thing as well to keep in mind, as frustrating as it can be in real life, especially if you live in a place that has one of these bans, or just like you and I just got one of these bans, or hasn't gone into effect quite yet. But, you know, the reality is they're really building jurisprudence on a Bill of Rights amendment from the ground up, and they've only done, you know, five or six cases. There's a lot to go. And that's why I would lean towards the idea that they're going to GVR these cases in light of Wolford once that's out, which should be probably this week. They got an opinion day tomorrow and Thursday.
Oh, okay. Tomorrow and Thursday.
They added one on Tuesday. And they can always add more. That's the other thing about watching the court is like, the court kind of can do whatever it wants. Yeah. But, you know, that's my expectation, because that's what they did after Rahimi, even in cases that didn't seem like there was going to be any change, and in the end didn't really produce any change in a lot of those cases that got GVR'd. You know, I think they just kind of want, and this is where you can also read this in the context of Kavanaugh talking about percolation. You look at that and you think, this case, you know, these hardware ban cases are very similar to Heller, and it's been almost 20 years since we have Heller. What kind of, how much more percolation could you need, right? But I think they look at it as, you know, we just created our official test for the Second Amendment in Bruin in 2022. And so let's see how the lower courts handle that. And we'll let things percolate after that new test and see how these lower courts actually apply it, now that we've said we don't like how you were doing it after Heller. And so in that, if you look at it from that point of view, the timeline compresses, and it's not as, you know, it's not as egregious, I guess, from that perspective. Yeah. And I think that's where the justices are coming from.
Yeah. I mean, although, you know, in Bruin, they said, listen, this isn't a new test. It's the same test we laid out in that's Heller, true. Right? So you could argue, I mean, again, it's been percolating since 2008. Yeah. you know, the this would be the if this if this, if these cases are GVR, this would be the second GVR for Duncan, right? Or the third GVR for Duncan. Yeah, I mean, that case has been kicking around for almost a decade now. And it, you know, it got up, I think, after Bruin. It was one of those that was remanded after Bruin. And so now it's back up again. That's why I'm hopeful that they'll hold on to these cases rather than just GVR them if they're not going to deny them outright. The good news is if they do end up, you know, GVR in these cases, send them back to the lower courts, you do still have Cheeseman versus Plackin out there. So we're not going to have to reset the clock all the way back to zero, right? There is that Third Circuit case. As Steven said, the expectation is, given the makeup of the Third Circuit, we're going to get a reasonably good decision striking down the ban on so-called assaults in magazines in New Jersey. Then the question becomes, does the Attorney General appeal that decision to the Supreme Court? Does she take the loss? You know, I then we start getting into some 4D chess here. We saw that with the carry issue, in Illinois when, they decided not to appeal a loss of the Seventh Circuit regarding the state's utter complete ban on carrying. And it took a few more years for us to get Bruin, right? It took a few more years for that issue to get decided. So maybe the anti-gunners decide to kick this case down the road. I hope not, but again, we'll see what happens. We won't have long to wait before we learn what the court's going to do with these cases. And in the meantime, as you say, you know, folks in Virginia, we've got our ban taking effect on July the 1st. We have a number of federal court challenges that even the plaintiffs acknowledge based on Fourth Circuit precedent. You know, these are vehicles to get to the Supreme Court. You've also got four state level challenges that are not implicated in the text of the Second Amendment. Instead, it's Article 1, Section 13 of the Virginia Constitution. One of these cases that had an injunctive hearing that got canceled that has now been pushed back to this week. There's a second case that also has a hearing. I believe both cases are only have hearings scheduled for the 25th. Another case out of Fauquier County is on hold while the Supreme Court appointed panel decides whether these cases should be consolidated. And then in Spotsylvania County, we had a case dealing with the argument was that not that the individual right to keep your arms was being violated, but that the militia clause of the Virginia Constitution is being violated by this gun ban because the Virginia Constitution defines the militia as the body of the people who are now, or at least soon, as of July the 1st, going to be unable to purchase firearms that are most useful in militia purposes. It's kind of interesting to see. I mean, the argument's interesting because we've had courts like the Fourth Circuit say, AR-15s aren't protected. They're too much like machine guns. They're unusually dangerous. This argument basically says, yeah, they are pretty close to machine guns, which is why they're protected for militia purposes. And a Spotsylvania County judge, this was, again, on a request for an injunction, denied that request, said he thinks the record shows that there is no right for Virginians to purchase these firearms, even for service in a militia, right? And Ken Cuccinelli, former Attorney General of Virginia, he's representing the plaintiffs in this case. He had a press conference on Friday. I was not able to attend, but you were a part of it. What was the Attorney General, what was Cuccinelli's reaction to the judge's decision? Are they going to appeal this case? Did he say anything about the reasoning that the judge used to reach his conclusion?
Yeah, well, one, I think he was pretty happy about how open the judge was to the argument. I think he's confident that this is something that could win on. It's obviously a little bit of a unique argument in terms of what we're used to seeing from Second Amendment, or in this case, Section 13 in Virginia is a almost identical parallel to the Second Amendment. But it actually, as you noted there, adds a little bit of further context about, well, who is the militia, right? It's essentially it's everybody. Obviously unhappy about the outcome of the case, but I think he understands, and I think people should understand that, like, it's difficult to get a preliminary injunction. That's the hardest thing to get when you're going to court, to enjoin a law that was just passed through a legislature. Judges are very hesitant to do that. And in this case, the judge didn't, think that they overcame that sort of burden to show that, this newly passed law is, is a detriment to the constitutional rights of Virginians. And he did talk about the appeal process. They haven't decided yet, though. I think he indicated essentially that they're very likely to appeal. You know, I asked him a bit about, you know, whether he thought they have a better chance in the higher courts and at the Virginia State Supreme Court, because, you know, the state Supreme Court has not done a lot on gun related cases over the years. They have one or two. There's one that essentially it was a sensitive places case out of Fairfax City. The George Mason University had a, you know, gun-free zones on certain buildings, and the court upheld those restrictions by incorporating the Second Amendment, saying the Section 13 basically means the same thing as the Second Amendment, and the Second Amendment allows for, especially at that time, this was pre-Bruin, though they may also survive, you know, a Bruin test, because their sensitive places are allowed under Bruin, as we know. Just sort of depends on exactly the details of them. But, you know, they said that the Section 13 is the same as the Second Amendment. And so he took that as a potential good sign. There's been some writings from at least one or two of the justices that he pointed out as, you know, potentially favoring Cuccinelli's point of view on this. And so, you know, he's pretty confident, but not, you know, he wasn't making any promises, I guess, at the end of the day, which is probably the right approach. I think these cases, all of these cases, are going to be hard, whether at the federal level or the state level. The state's a little bit more of a wild card. I think you'd probably agree.
Yeah.
Because we don't have as much, you know, concrete rulings to go off of to see what the thinking of the Supreme Court justices in Virginia are, as opposed to, like, the problem with the Supreme Court of the United States is they just don't take up a lot of cases. We're sort of, what I was giving a little bit of a defense of the court's thinking earlier, but they could, of course, clear up a lot of the questions around their Second Amendment jurisprudence if they just took more cases, but they don't take a lot of cases generally as a court compared to previous courts. So they don't really like to do that. And so that's the big hold up at the federal level, is they just, we can't really grasp pretty well what their thinking is about the Second Amendment and how far it extends, but they don't take enough cases to make a big impact and to really set the rules for the lower courts. And so that's been the issue in this Virginia Supreme Court. They just haven't heard a lot of Section 13 or, you know, Second Amendment type challenges.
So right.
It's hard to predict exactly where they're going to go. You know, this is probably my favorite personally of the challenges. I think they get the analysis right of what both the Second Amendment and Section 13 actually do and what they're for and what they mean. But they are outliers from what, you know, for instance, the Supreme Court has interpreted the Second Amendment to mean. You know, it's about an individual right, but they've disconnected it from the militia aspect. Whereas, you know, I think they make more sense intermingled in the, and it's more explicitly that way in the actual Virginia Constitution in Section 13. But we'll see how much that sort of more novel argument, even if it is more accurate in my view, whether that, you know, penetrates the way that just in a more traditional Second Amendment type individual right to keep and bear arms argument is going to do with these in these other numerous other challenges, you know, NSSF, yeah. NRA, GOA, at VCDL, they all have, you know, more traditional arguments in their cases that I think judges are going to be more used to hearing and litigating. But I mean, I think they're all a long shot at the end of the day. It's hard to undo a law like this, especially before it goes into effect. And, you know, to me, the biggest shot, the best chance you have is the Supreme Court, you know, the United States, and them ruling in some other case that's much further along than any of these Virginia cases.
Right. Yeah. Whether it's Cheeseman or any of the hardware ban cases. Well, we'll see. Again, the 25th, you've got hearings in Lancaster County and the northwestern part of the state, and Washington County and the southwestern part of the state. So you just need one judge to issue the injunction.
And that's kind of the, like, what is it, Avengers Endgame, one path through is, like, you get a lower court judge here in Virginia to block implementation, and then the Supreme Court takes right. up one of these other challenges. That's the way that I could see this never going into effect, but it is a
long shot. Yeah, for sure. And, you know, as for Cheeseman, we don't know when that case is going to be dropped by the Third Circuit, probably at some point this summer. Again, speculation is that the Third Circuit's waiting to see what the Supreme Court does in Hamani and Wolford. We now know what they're going to do in Hamani because we've seen that opinion. We'll see what happens with Wolford. That may be coming out again as early as tomorrow. But a lot to keep an eye on in the courts. And, of course, Stephen does a fantastic job of that at thereload.com. How can folks sign up and become a subscriber, Stephen?
You can head over to thereload.com and check out our membership options. We've got monthly or yearly. And, of course, we have a free newsletter if you just want to see what we're all about first before you take that dive. And, you know, all of our reporting, our hard news stuff is in front of the paywall. So give you a good idea of what we do over there.
Well, again, man, I appreciate you coming on the program. It's always a good time talking with you, even when we the news is kind of frustrating. And we do have some good news to talk about, you know, with Hamani. Unfortunately, we don't have the time. But I look forward to having you back again in the very, very near future. And I look forward to appearing on the Reload podcast before long, too.
Absolutely. Love to have you back on.
All right. Thanks, Stephen. My thanks to Stephen for joining us on the program. And we will be keeping our eyes on the Supreme Court tomorrow, where more opinions will be released starting at 10 a.m. Eastern time. So if we do get the Wolford case, hopefully it'll be one of the first released, and we can go through that opinion on tomorrow's Barry and Arms Scamming Company. All right, right now let's turn to our good deed of the day, our recidivist report, and our armed citizen story. We'll start with the recidivist report, a case out of Massachusetts. Here's the headline. Suspect in deadly Mattapan carjacking has long criminal history, court records show. So this carjacking happened over the weekend in the Boston neighborhood of Mattapan. According to authorities, this individual, identified as 37-year-old Ibrahim Matos, ended up yanking a person out of their car, getting behind the wheel and driving away, and then a short distance later striking and killing a pedestrian. He then tried to run away, but other people who were there on the scene saw what happened. The bystanders ended up holding him until police arrived. And as it turns out, Matos has a, quote, extensive criminal history, according to court records. He is now charged with murder, carjacking, leaving the scene of an accident resulting in death, and leaving the scene of an accident resulting in personal injury. He is scheduled to go before a judge today on a dangerousness hearing. But as Mass Live reports, between 2009 and 2023, Matos has logged at least 15 different criminal cases, abuse prevention, and restraining orders in Roxbury and West Roxbury Municipal Court, not including the charges that were filed as a result of this carjacking and pedestrian death over the weekend. Now, again, these were municipal court cases. These weren't necessarily high-profile, serious felony charges. But there were, again, multiple opportunities for intervention here. When you've got basically one court case a year, or one criminal charge a year, for a period of 14 years, you know, most of us will go our entire lives without having anything like that on our record. When you're racking up one a year for over a decade on average, whether it's, again, a criminal case, whether it's a restraining order, that's a sign there's a problem there, right? And yet, in Massachusetts and in so many other states, the criminal justice system basically shrugs. And until you commit a crime that is so heinous that it ends up on the front page of the newspaper, or it leaves the nightly news, like, I don't know, carjacking somebody and then running over a pedestrian, the criminal justice system is probably going to give you a pass. And particularly in these blue states where it seems like there is more interest in using the law to dissuade people from exercising their Second Amendment rights than it is to actually ensure that criminals, not you know, those convicted of possessory offenses, but those who've actually done harm to others, face any kind of consequence for their actions. Again, maybe things will change now that Matos is accused of a crime that did leave the nightly news, that is still making front page news a couple of days later. But there were multiple opportunities to address Matos' behavior long before this attempted carjacking this past weekend. Today's armed citizen story from Blue Springs, Missouri, where a shooting during a break-in shook up a quiet Blue Springs neighborhood, as these defensive gun uses tend to do, right? I mean, most of us live in pretty quiet places, pretty quiet neighborhoods. But that doesn't mean that we are immune from crime. Even if you live in a gated community, it doesn't mean that you are immune from crime. This happened early Friday morning. A homeowner shot and killed a suspected intruder after reporting a break-in. Police say the homeowner did report the break-in and then shot the suspect before officers arrived. Suspect died at the scene. Neighbors told KCTV Channel 5 that the incident has left them shaken. They described the neighborhood again as pretty quiet. James Anoye, who's a neighbor, said, "I'm just more in shock than anything." Oscar Kibkoros, who also lives in the neighborhood, said the shooting has him questioning his safety. He said, "It makes me wonder, what if it were me? I don't want to jeopardize my child or my family." Well, I would tell Oscar, if he's concerned about somebody breaking into his home, he wants to be able to protect his family. Listen, there are options for you to store your firearm in a way that, yes, it's going to take you a little bit longer to get to it. That is the trade-off. But there is a way for you to store your firearm in a way that it is going to be inaccessible to your child, still accessible to you in a reasonable, reasonable is an arbitrary term, right? Hopefully still accessible to you. Certainly more accessible than having to wait for police to arrive. Let's put it that way. Zion Torres, who used to live next door, said the incident was unexpected. He said, "I was appalled because I'm like, for the most part, it's quiet around here. No issues, anything. So to hear that this happened, this could potentially happen to us, it's disheartening." Kim Koros, the guy who said he was concerned about jeopardizing his child or his family, said, "I don't know how I would have reacted." He says, "It makes me now think, hey, maybe I need to look for a new place." I mean, I guess, but again, violent crime can happen anywhere. Burglaries can happen anywhere. It doesn't have to be in a high crime neighborhood. It can be in a leafy cul-de-sac. It can be in a high-rise apartment building. So the idea that you're going to move somewhere and automatically become safe, that's a fallacy. I think the more logical response is, what can I do to improve the safety of myself and my family where I live right now? And again, if this is a pretty quiet neighborhood generally, you know, it's a type of neighborhood you want your kids to grow up in, stay. Just because somebody broke into somebody's house doesn't mean that all of a sudden you need to pack up and move. Again, I don't know where there are burglary-free neighborhoods. That's kind of an odd lesson to take away from this, right? To me, the lesson would be, man, I'm really concerned about my safety, the safety of others. Thank goodness my neighbor was able to protect his family, had the means to do so. Hey, I need to go talk to my neighbor. Maybe I need to go take a basic pistol class. Maybe I need to see if gun ownership is right for me. I would do that over the moving van 10 out of 10 times. Let's hope that Mr. Kibkoros eventually reaches the same conclusion. Finally today, our good deed of the day: in the right place at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. A neighbor who saved a family in the Cincinnati area, Middletown, Ohio. WKRC in Cincinnati reporting on the heroism there. Neighbor saves family after fire starts outside a Middletown home. Still don't know what caused the blaze. It was Sunday morning. Crews responded around 10:15 in the morning after receiving reports of a fire. A witness told officials that the fire appeared to start outside the home before it then spread. Footage from the scene shows the side of the home blackened and charred. According to reports from the scene, a neighbor actually went inside the residence, was able to help the family inside escape to safety. Doesn't sound like there were any injuries. I don't think anybody was taken to the hospital there at the scene. So it looks like everybody's going to be okay. The cause of the fire remains under investigation. Looks like crews may have gotten there again based just on a couple of photos that I've seen. Crews may have gotten there quickly enough that the home is not a total loss. There's still some damage done to, you know, a room of the home and maybe the roof of the home. But hopefully this family is going to be able to get back inside. And the fact that they are alive and well today because their neighbor came to their aid. Don't know the name of that good Samaritan, but whoever you are, we appreciate you being in the right place at the right time and willing and able to do the right thing. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms Cam & Company. And I do want to thank you for being a part of the program. As always, I would encourage you to check out BearingArms.com throughout the rest of the day today, keeping you up to date on what's going on around the country when it comes to your right to keep and bear arms. Got a number of stories on Virginia. I promise we're not trying to be Virginia exclusive. It's just that this is where the looming deadline is approaching right now. But we're also taking a look back at the Hamani case. And the it's funny to me, the gun control supporters who don't want to complain about this decision, because there are a lot of folks on the left who would say you shouldn't go to jail for possessing marijuana. You probably shouldn't go to jail just for possessing guns. And you probably shouldn't go to jail just for possessing guns as a marijuana user. That's a little too war on drugsy for a lot of folks on the left. So the gun control advocates are trying to thread that needle of, well, maybe this decision wasn't the worst decision, but they got to have something to complain about. And they're finding it. We've got that for you at Bearing Arms as well. Enjoy the rest of your Monday. Looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Until then, be well, be safe, and be free.